of the world, even as I am not of the world. Sanctify them through thy truth. Thy word is truth. As thou hast sent me into the world, even so have I also sent them into the world. And for their sakes I sanctify myself, that they also might be sanctified through the truth. Neither pray I for these alone, but for them also which shall believe on me through their word, that they all may be one, as thou, Father, art in me, and I in thee, that they also may be one in us, that the world may believe that thou hast sent me. And the glory which thou gavest me I have given them, that they may be one, even as we are one. I in them, thou in me, that they may be made perfect in one, and that the world may know that thou hast sent me, and hast loved them as thou hast loved me. Well, after that there follows, as we know, the familiar story told in detail in all four Gospels of the events that lead to the entombment and resurrection, when the last enemy death is completely and finally routed. And Jesus, in Mrs. Eddy's words, steps forth from his gloomy resting place crowned with the glory of a sublime success, an everlasting victory. At Science and Health, page 45. And of course, he's done it not for himself personally, but on behalf of all mankind. Well, as a result, the veil of the temple is rent in twain from top to bottom. And that means that now the whole world, not just Jesus, can be reflected and understood as being one with God. Remember the way in which Revelation 11 leads to Revelation 12, where it says that the temple of God was opened in heaven. No separating veil, you see, hiding the view. And you remember what the view is? How this reveals in chapter 12, the birth-giving mother, the woman in the apocalypse who is said to symbolize generic man. The human race itself, you see, like the rays of the sun, shining forth the divine principle love. Could anything be more wonderful than that? But then this is what Jesus has known all the way along to be the absolute truth regarding himself and his world. It's the very vision which alone enables him to triumph in the way he does. in the course of his public ministry. So lastly then, shall we touch on the public ministry? You see it there in the center of the chart? Whereas if he's clothed with the rays of the sun, like the woman, he's looking out subjectively from the central standpoint of principle itself and seeing his world as the principle itself sees it. Well, again, it's Matthew, Mark, and Luke whose accounts are so very similar, and John, as usual, who is so markedly different. But here's something perhaps surprising. That extremely crucial event that takes place in the course of the public ministry called the Transfiguration isn't referred to at all in John, but is, of course, in the other three Gospels. Now, perhaps the reason, you think, is that John's view of Jesus, compared with that of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, is consistently that of the Transfiguration itself? You see, the Word that is with God, the Word that is God, which, as we remember, is John's estimate of what Jesus truly is, could scarcely be other than the way the Transfiguration presents him as being. What do you think? Anyway, you remember how, in company with Peter, James, and John, he goes up the mountain, and in the words of the text, is transfigured before them. And his face did shine as the sun. Think of the woman clothed with the sun again. His face did shine as the sun, and his raiment was white as the light. And behold, there appeared unto them Moses and Elias talking with him. Moses, the past. Jesus, the present. Elias, defined in the glossary as Christian science, standing for the future. No time, therefore, but past, present, and future, all one, now. Whereas three disciples want to build three separate tabernacles for the three of them, thereby retaining belief in the three aspects of time. You see, the Transfiguration is imperative because it's the standpoint from which Jesus is enabled to complete his mission. First to triumph over the crucifixion when he has a thief on one side of him and another thief on the other side. The thief of the past and the thief of the future, always trying to rob us of the present, aren't they? But the Moses, Jesus, Elias situation at the Transfiguration is specifically the divine answer to this, and brings about the resurrection as a result. Transfiguration, resurrection, with crucifixion accordingly displayed disposed of in between enables him finally to attain the ascension. Do you see? And therefore to conclude his mission. It's a wonderful fourfold scientific order when you think about it, isn't it? And one which we might do well to give a lot of prayerful thought to. But back now to the period of the ministry in general. In the three synoptic gospels, instantaneous healings proliferate and abound, don't they? Not only on the individual scale, but on the mass scale too. Even as do the teachings through parables and all the different manifestations of power which we find recorded there. It's in John that is all so different. In John, four healings only put on record, and each one peculiar to John. They are these four. One, the raising of the nobleman's son. Two, the healing of the impotent man at the pool of Bethesda. Three, the healing of the man born blind. And four, most outstanding of all, the raising of Lazarus. Always the healing appears to be instantaneous, doesn't it? In Matthew, for example, immediately the leprosy was cleansed. In Mark, immediately the sick of the palsy arose, took up his bed, and went forth before them all. In Luke, immediately Simon's wife's mother's fever left her, and she arose and ministered unto them, and so on, and so on, and so on. But let's take in John the case of the man born blind, shall we? Of course, the thing that matters in every case is not really the instantaneous change of sense evidence. That, of course, is important. But more important is what is the state of the Christ consciousness that actually determines and produces this change of evidence. That obviously is the thing that really matters, isn't it? And in the case of the man born blind, it's the fact that to the consciousness of Jesus, I, the one Christ, truth, am the light of the world. I'm the light of the world, he's just recently declared. I'm like the ceaseless shining forth of the light of the sun. Remember the woman? I'm the light sent forth by the source of this light, so that in me, therefore in my world, there's no vestige of blindness or darkness. The light that I am is therefore the light that you are, he implies to the blind man. I am not a man made of clay. Hence the clay man that I am not is the clay man that you're not either. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world, he repeats. And he spat on the ground and made clay of the spittle, and anointed the eyes of the blind man with the clay, and said unto him, Go, wash in the pool of Siloam, which is by interpretation sent. You see, the Father hath sent me. Just like the sun sending forth its rays of light. He washed, therefore, and came seeing. Then the people said unto him, How were thine eyes opened? He answered and said, A man that is called Jesus made clay, and anointed mine eyes, and said unto me, Go to the pool of Siloam and wash. I went and washed, and I received my sight. One thing I know, that whereas I was blind, now I see. Now the answer, the healing truth then is that the everywhere present light of the world is sent forth by the divine source of this light to wash away the blindness of the world's belief in its own Adamic clay origin. The belief, therefore, in its being born blind. Lastly then, and with the greatest humility, let's try and take a look, shall we, at this marvellous account which John gives of the raising of Lazarus from the dead. Do you remember how, in the case of the man born blind, they asked Jesus, Who did sin, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? And Jesus answered, Neither. Neither hath this man sinned, nor his parents, but that the works of God should be made manifest in him. Think of that, that the works of God should be made manifest in him. Do we see the wonderful science implicit in that reply? You see, it isn't really a matter of healing what appears as a case of personal blindness. That's just the evidence of the senses. It could easily be a red herring if we were to accept it. You see, what the healing really amounts to, and what actually accomplishes the healing, is the works of God being made manifest. Divine reality, that's to say, in which there's no such thing as blindness, of course, being made manifest humanly. Just as when the textbook tells us, you remember, that the divinity of the Christ was made manifest in the humanity of Jesus. Isn't that wonderful? Because this same radical healing standpoint persists with the raising of Lazarus. Don't be fooled. Don't be deceived Jesus seems to be saying. This sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God might be glorified thereby. That the glory which is divinely might be seen to be manifest humanly. Because the glory of the Son, manifesting humanly the glory of the Father, includes not only the glory of the identity, the true identity which is Lazarus, but the glory also of all mankind. Do we see how error, being completely detached in this way from persons, undermines totally the carnal mind, which succeeds in its deceptions only if he can attach a first personal pronoun to its own false claims? If it can cause its victims, that is, to say, I am it, it's me, it's my disability, my infirmity, when in truth, in science, it never is. It's only ever mesmeric suggestion appearing on the surface of consciousness with a view to manifesting personally the carnal mind. See, the answer then, please God, is for humanity to manifest the glory of divinity rather than manifest the errors of carnality. So Jesus says, our friend Lazarus sleepeth, but I go that I may wake him out of sleep, out of the deep hypnotic stupor of the Adam dream, that is, or out of the collective or psychic so-called unconscious, so that the human may be seen to come forth from the divine and not from the deep, dark underworld of elemental carnality. But then, because of the apparently hard and fast evidence of the senses, Jesus changes his original verdict, Lazarus sleepeth, and agrees that Lazarus is dead. And when he came, he found that he'd lain in the grave 4 days already. And just as the healing truth relative to the man born blind was, I am the light of the world, so in the case of the apparently dead Lazarus, it's I am the resurrection and the life. He that believeth on me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. In other words, the life that I, the Son of God, am manifesting humanly to the glory of God is necessarily the very same life that Lazarus is manifesting. Just the same way that the light which I'm manifesting is the light of the man born blind. Neither, therefore, is Lazarus really dead, nor the man really blind. The one life, the ever-present light that I am reflecting is the very life which God is, and which has never therefore been disintegrated into a host of personally possessed eyes or personally possessed lives subject to decay and death. Jesus therefore cometh to the grave. It was a cave, and a stone lay upon it. Jesus said, "Take ye away the stone," implying, isn't it, that the mesmerism which needs to be lifted is what you onlookers are believing regarding life and death in matter. The myth that life lives and dies in the body. It's not what I am believing, he says, nor even what Lazarus is believing. Lazarus never either lived or died in that body which you think you laid in the tomb. Then they took away the stone from the place where the dead was laid. They took it away, you see. And Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, "Father, I thank thee that thou hast heard me." Do we see how he acknowledges the absolute truth of the situation before the evidence changes? He doesn't wait first for the change and then give thanks to God. What a lesson that is, isn't it? "And I knew that thou hearest me always," he says, "but because of the people that stand by, I said it, that they may believe that thou hast sent me." That they may understand that there is but one eternal, indestructible life, and that I, the Son of God, including Lazarus, including all of you and all mankind, am its forever manifestation. In other words, the demonstration of self-existent life is already made in God, by God. And therefore life has never died. The evidence that it has is in the thought of you onlookers only. And what I'm about to do is to relieve you of this, or so he implies. And when he'd spoken, he cried with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come forth." And he that was dead came forth, bound hand and foot with grave clothes. Jesus saith unto them, "Loose him and let him go." That's to say, you loose, you dissolve your binding false mortal sense of him. So that divinity is not one thing and humanity another, but the human becomes to you none other than the divine itself made manifest. Do we see that? All right. Now, shall we just note how Lazarus lay in the grave 4 days, and how Jesus, when it comes to it, is in the sepulchre 3 days, signifying symbolically how it takes the full span of all 7 days for life, objectively and subjectively, to pass completely over death. That is to reveal eternity, newness of life. Which is the way, isn't it, that the textbook describes the workings of the 7 days of creation as a whole. Just think correlatively on the grand scale of the Old Testament's 4,000-year periods, corresponding to the first 4 days of creation, and how these 4 periods prepare the way objectively for the New Testament's remaining 3,000-year periods, corresponding subjectively to the final 3 days of creation. How do you like that? So what a remarkable difference it makes, doesn't it? When we find ourselves thinking in the realm of minds, spiritually scientific, minds spiritually interwoven, revolving ideas, instead of in the realm of time and literal historical happenings. Agreed? So perhaps it's nice that this thought of the full range of the 7 timeless days of creation takes us back to the point from which we started out today, when we thought about this divine sevenfold order in relation to the complete span of the Bible from Genesis to Revelation, and saw this so perfectly focused in Jesus' stupendous life work as it ranges from the Nativity to the Ascension. Yes. All right, well, let's close now, shall we, by reminding ourselves again that as the outcome of the consciousness of Israel's 16 prophets and their elucidation of the great holistic life principle that closes the Old Testament, we enter upon the dominant tone of life itself, where in the words of Isaiah, regarding our own real Christ selfhood that's being revealed to us, now think of it, unto us a child, a glorious new spiritual idea is born. Unto us a son is given, and the government of ourselves individually, each other collectively, and mankind as a whole universally, shall be upon his shoulder. And his name shall be called Wonderful. Well, isn't the idea wonderful? His name should be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. Because the idea itself, in its eternal science, is no less than that of the principle of total world salvation and peace. Because it's being born of the New Jerusalem, or City of Peace, and therefore of the Mother of us all. Hence, of the increase of his government and peace, there shall be no end. Upon the throne of David, and upon his kingdom, to order it, and to establish it with judgment and with justice, from henceforth, even forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. And why will the zeal of the Lord of hosts perform it? Because in truth, in science, it already is the underlying fact of the being of every one of us and of all mankind here and now, and doesn't really have to be made so. Therefore, what we have to do is to learn to let it unfold itself from within its own being, and each of us be ready and willing to play his God-appointed part in this worldwide unfoldment that must inevitably come about in its own orderly way. So from the four Gospels, where we see this idea being sent forth from and by the Father, sent forth by the divine principle love, that is, we come in due course to the Acts of the Apostles. Significant? Indeed it is. Because the root meaning of the word apostle, just like the word epistle, is to send, involving precisely the same idea, therefore, that we see in the Gospels of being sent forth from and by the one divine Father-Mother principle. And therefore, just as the idea in its oneness, typified by the individual Christ Jesus, is necessarily sent forth first, this becomes true for all of us secondly, as the universal Christ body, sent forth as Christianity, Christianity itself having revealed itself today in its living science and system. So thank you, everybody.
End of recording.